About once every 6 months, we have to turn in a new instruction set to tell people how to set up the chairs. Somehow, this group seems to have just grown this way, and these have receded a bit. It's a little disconcerting. It looks a little different from up here. Okay, we have spent a very long time looking at the Ten Commandments and looking at things around it, and it's time now for us to move on. So if you could find Exodus chapter 20. And what I want to do is I want to begin by orienting you to what you're going to find after the Ten Commandments were given. Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, God spoke all these words, and the words that follow are the words of the Ten Commandments. Verse 18, there was so much going on, thunder pealing, lightning flashing, trumpet blasting, and mountain smoking. I've got four ing words across there, do you? The people were so terrified that they said to Moses, "You go find out all the details of what he wants. You come back and tell us. We don't want to hear him again. We're going to die if we hear God's voice again." And so what follows beginning in verse 22, is a conversation that God has with Moses. We don't hear Moses' side. We hear what God said to Moses. We presume that Moses probably had some things to say, but those aren't recorded. That conversation, or that dialogue, or that set of instructions goes through chapter 23 and into the first two verses of chapter 24. Starting at verse 3 of chapter 24, there's a brief section where Moses does some things that God had told him to do immediately. Those things happen. And then, if you look at verse 17 and 18 of chapter 24, you see that Moses goes back up the mountain to have another conversation with God. Look at the tail end of verse 18 of chapter 24. How long did he stay this time?
40 days and 40 nights,
a period of time that we have seen several other places in Scripture. So, starting at chapter 25, verse 1, there's a second conversation, which again, we only hear God's side of that. We hear what God has to say. And that conversation runs through chapter 31. Verse 18 of chapter 31 more or less concludes that. So what we have here are two sections of God giving instruction to Moses, instructions that are to be passed on to the people. There's a brief interlude in chapter 24, I think it is. There's a brief interlude in there, and then it all begins up again. And then chapter 32 is where the second dialogue, conversation, and instruction set ends, and Moses comes back down the mountain the second time. Now, that's the orientation. And what I propose to do is I propose to look a little bit at the first conversation, and a little bit at the second conversation, look at what happened in that interim between the two, and then look at what happened in chapter 32. Now, if you've been here regularly, you already know what happens by chapter 32. But I want to try to put this into some kind of context. Let's take a brief look at chapter 24, because I think it's important for you to see this. We're going to come back in a moment or two and talk about what happens in the rest of chapter 20, 21, 22, 23. If you look in chapter 24, God has given instructions. Verse 1 of chapter 24, He, that is God, said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel. Bow down at a distance. Moses alone will approach the Lord. The others will not approach, nor will the people come up with them." Verse 3, Moses went and told the people something. What did he tell them? Told them all the words and law that God had given. Now, if you skip down just a little bit to verse 4, it says something very important. What happens? What does verse 4 tell you?
He writes it down.
Moses writes it all down. If you come to verse 7, Moses takes something in his hands, according to my translation, and reads from it to the listening people. What does he have in his hand?
Book of the Covenant.
What's that? This isn't hard. This is what he wrote down. Let's review for just a second. Verse 3, he comes down, and what does he do? Tells the people all the things that God has said. Verse 4, writes it all down. Verse 7, he reads it back to them. How many times have the people heard it?
Twice
at least. Plus, they have heard the concentrated part of the Ten Commandments. So, what seems to be talking about here is what God has said in the Ten Commandments, plus what God has said to Moses in chapter 20, the rest of chapter 20, 21, 22, 23. All of that he has now written down, and the people have heard it at least twice. So far, okay? Verse 8, what do the people say? What do the people say? We will do, or shall do, everything that God has said. Semicolon. And it says something else. We will obey. We're going to do everything they said. We're going to obey. Right? How many times have they heard the law? The Book of the Covenant? Once from God himself, in a concentrated form. And now twice from Moses. What's the people's response? We're going to do it. Every bit of it. Not going to skip a part. Everybody okay? Now, verse 9. I guess this is verse 8. That was the tail end of verse 7. Verse 8, what does Moses do? Where'd the blood come from? Where did the blood come from? That came from the tail end of verse 4. He built an altar. Verse 5, he sent some of the young Israelites, mine says certain young Israelites, to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice bulls to the Lord as communion sacrifices. Took half of the blood, put it into basins, the other half he sprinkled on the altar, and now in verse 8, he sprinkles this over the people. And what does he say? This is the blood of the covenant. A covenant is being sealed. The words of the book of the covenant are the laws. The people have agreed to that, and that has been sealed. There has been a ceremony. Right? And the people have been part of all of that. Verse 9, what happens now? Those people God had named go somewhere. Where do they go? Mine says up. Mine doesn't say up the mountain, but that's implied. Mine just says up. Does yours say up? Verse 10, what did they see? They saw the God of Israel, beneath whose feet there was what looked like a sapphire pavement, as pure as the heavens themselves. But he, that is God, did no harm to the Israelite notables. They actually gazed on God, and then they ate and drank. I need to do this. I apologize to half of you. I apologize right now to half of you, but I need to do this. Okay? I went to the worship service this morning at our church at 8 o'clock. So did you. I didn't see you there. You're going at 11. I apologize to you for what I'm about to do. Okay. You all were there. Okay, I didn't see you. Were you there?
No.
Okay, so I apologize to you. You guys are okay. What's the sermon about today? Ordinary people, extraordinary stories. The focus today was Elisha, who was a prophet who started out as a servant to Elijah. So far, okay? How many books of the law in the Bible?
Five.
Okay. How many books of history?
12.
How many books of the wisdom literature?
Five.
How many books of prophecy?
5 plus 12.
17. 5 plus 12. The five are called major prophets. The 12 are called minor prophets. Okay, are the major prophets the important ones? Well, certainly they're important. Are the minor prophets unimportant?
No.
Why are they called minor prophets? Small books. Why are the major prophets called major prophets? Big books. Where's Elijah's book? Elijah doesn't have one. He's one of the most important prophets there is. Okay? Doesn't have a book. But he's one of the most important prophets. He takes on Elisha as his servant. And when Elijah is taken back to heaven, and I said that correctly, when Elijah is taken back to heaven, Elisha becomes prophet in his place. Now, here's the first of my apologies. I apologize because I'm going to tell you a little bit more that Travis didn't tell the first group. And that means that when you get there, you're going to be thinking about this and not about what he's saying. Elisha said to Elijah, "Would you give me something as you go?" Elijah says what? He says, "I want a double portion of your spirit. I want a double portion of your spirit." Elijah says, "That's not really mine to give, but I can tell you, if you see me go, you'll have it." And he saw him go. How many miracles did Elijah do? Answer is, we don't know. But most people think 8 are recorded. Depends on how you count. How many miracles are recorded for Elisha? 16. Elisha got a double portion of Elijah's spirit. Okay? Elisha was a powerful, powerful prophet. So who was his servant? You're supposed to know because we have talked about this. Bravo, you got the first Gehazi. Okay. Who was Elijah's servant? Elisha. And when Elijah left, Elisha became a prophet with double portion of Elijah's spirit. Who was Elisha's servant? Gehazi. Who was supposed to take over when Elisha was gone? Gehazi. Did he?
No.
Why not? Because of the things that happened around Naaman's cure from leprosy. We have a name for that process. We don't do it much anymore. But it is an honorable tradition. Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer who never went to law school. How did he become a lawyer? He apprenticed himself to a working lawyer and learned how to do the law. Elisha was the apprentice. Servant gives you one impression. That's the wrong impression. Apprentice comes closer. The most important thing any leader can do is to help somebody else be trained so that when that person is gone, somebody else is in their place. I thought about a week ago as I was thinking about this. I'm not sure who's going to take over this class if something happens to me. That's an interesting thought. It's kind of scary to stand up in front of 80 or 90 people without a curriculum, right? We don't have a curriculum because we're going to pick it up from Brill's office. Was that where they said to go? Elijah trained Elisha. Elisha was training Gehazi. Gehazi stumbled and stumbled badly. And there wasn't... I look back into the Bible and I think, what would have happened if Gehazi had stayed honorable? If Gehazi had not had the stumble he had? That's hiding in this. Okay. Now, Gehazi figured in the sermon this morning. Once again, I apologize. What happened with Gehazi? Those of you who were there, some of you were there. Maybe you're not putting this together. A crowd of soldiers, horses and chariots, surround the house because God has been giving him insight into what this king is doing who's trying to attack Israel, and that has allowed the king of Israel to thwart this power at every turn. So they come to kill Elisha. And they get up in the morning and the servant looks outside and he sees the horses and the chariots and he says, "Oh my father, what are we going to do?" And Elisha prays. I apologize. He prays two prayers. You were told about one. What was the prayer you were told about? God opened his eyes. And when his eyes were open, what did he see? Here's the army surrounding Elisha. Here's the army surrounding Elisha. You try to say that. And what did he see? Horses and chariots of fire. Whose eyes were open? Gehazi's eyes were open. Gehazi was in training to be a prophet. Okay? What was the next prayer? The pastor stopped at that point. Why? Too much time. He didn't have enough time to do this. We got a little time here. What was the next prayer? The next prayer was about the army that surrounded the house. What was the prayer for Gehazi? Open his eyes and let him see. What was the prayer for the army surrounding the house? Close their eyes and make them blind. Okay? And what happened with that army? Elisha had them brought in, and when their eyes were open, they were all surrounded by a much more powerful force. So what did they do? Kill them all?
Fed them lunch.
And sent them home. And the army wasn't a problem anymore. Open their eyes, let them see. Close their eyes where they're blind. There's a spiritual message in here if you want to. Okay? Have any of you figured out why I'm talking about this? Have any of you figured out why I'm talking about this? The leaders of Israel have just gone up the mountain. What did they see? That was my question of you. The answer, I think, is in verse 10 of chapter 24 of Exodus. What did they see? They saw God Himself in His glory. They gazed on His presence, and in His presence they ate and drank. They did not die. They ate and drank. They were allowed to see everything Moses had seen. They didn't hear everything Moses heard, but they were allowed to see what Moses had seen. If you were allowed that vision, how long would it last? Gehazi was allowed that vision. How long did it last? Not long. And there's the tragedy for Gehazi. How long did these people hold on to their vision? Not long. And that's the story of Exodus 32. We're not to Exodus 32. But when we get to Exodus 32, you must, if you're going to have any chance of understanding what you're reading, you must see that Exodus 32 comes with the leaders completely forgetting what they have seen and going off in some other direction. Where is God? They said. We don't have one anymore. So, before we start to dig into this, this is about 10, 15 chapters long, this section. I need you to see the overarching picture. Moses has gone to be with God. He has come back. He's told the people what he's heard to put together with what they heard with their own ears. He has written it down. He has read it to them again. They have agreed to do everything God has said to obey. He has sprinkled the blood of the sacrifice on them, and that has sealed the covenant. The leaders of the people are then allowed to see what Moses has seen, which should have been enough to last 1,000 lifetimes. And it doesn't last 40 days and 40 nights. It doesn't last. There's a tragedy in the middle of this story. And that tragedy is deep. And that tragedy is wide. The leaders of the people, Aaron, Abihu, and the others that are named, 70 that aren't named, they saw God and they turned away and seemed to have forgotten what they saw. Okay. You doing all right so far? Okay. I'd like you to look very briefly, starting at chapter 20, verse 22. In my translation, verse 22 of chapter 20 begins, "The Lord said to Moses," there is then a quotation mark, and then there are words. Each successive paragraph for three or four chapters begins with that quotation mark. Is yours marked that way?
Yes.
If you happen to have a more modern translation, you may have these things broken out into sections with headings. That's helpful if you have that, because it helps you divide these things out. The instructions begin with a repeat of one of the Ten Commandments in verse 23. Don't make false gods. Verse 24, you must make me an altar of earth on which to sacrifice your burnt offerings. And then there's a very fascinating sentence, because this is something that gets changed later. Wherever I choose to have my name remembered, I will come to you and bless you. If you make your altar of stone, do not make it of dressed stones, for if you use a chisel on it, you will profane it. And then it says something that makes you think you can tell something about the way they were dressed when they went to the altar. So the very first thing he talks about is the altar of sacrifice. He talks about something having to do with worship. There's 13 little sections of laws in what follows. This is the first section. And it's not until section 8 that he returns to anything that has to do with worship or morality. Everything else from the second one through the seventh one is talking about treatment of each other, interactions between people. Chapter 21 starts out with commentaries about slaves and slavery. Verse 12 starts to talk about homicide, death, either deliberate or accidental. Verse 18 starts to talk about assaults and wounds. Chapter 22, or the tail end of chapter 21, begins to talk about thefts, especially thefts of animals. Around chapter 5 verse 5 of chapter 22, it begins to talk about damage that animals do to property and what happens to their owners when those things happen, or what happens to an animal, what happens if an animal you have borrowed has been damaged while in your care. Very, very strange and disturbing piece in verse 16 and 17 of chapter 22. And then finally, in verse 17 of chapter 22, it returns to things about morality or other aspects of interaction with God. Pay attention to verse 28. Verse 28 talks about first fruits and firstborn, how those are to be given to the Lord. Chapter 23 opens with talking about justice, duty towards enemies, duties towards the poor, duties towards aliens who live among you. Chapter 23, verse 10, talks about sabbaticals. A sabbatical, every 7 days, the Sabbath for people. Every 7 years, a Sabbath for the land. You're supposed to let the land lie fallow. We know now from agricultural experts that there's value in letting land lie fallow every certain, this rotation of crops, grow different things and let the land lie. But this is very early. Verse 14, it talks about great feasts, three of them through the year. And then finally in verse 20 of chapter 23, it talks about what's going to happen when the people go into the promised land. 13 sections of information that he's giving here. I'm going to come back in a minute and pick out some important pieces here. But I want you to see the thrust of this. Worship early, some things about morality in the middle, but a lot about justice and interacting with each other. Okay? The other side of the interlude, chapter 25 and 26 up through 31, what's he talking about there? It's like a totally different conversation. He's talking about different things. If you look in chapter 25, you can follow this. He begins in chapter 25 to talk about how the contributions of people who are led to do so by their hearts are going to provide the materials to make a worship center. Starting in verse 10 of chapter 25, he talks about how the worship center, he calls, in this translation it's called the dwelling, in yours it may be called the tabernacle, how that's going to be built, the materials, the dimensions, the furnishings, the ornamentation, all of that. Verse 23 and beyond talks about a table for loaves of offering. Verse 31 talks about a lampstand and goes on for a while. Chapter 26 begins with talking about the fabrics and the hangings. The tabernacle was essentially a tent. So the things that would make the walls of that tent would be fabric sheets of some kind. Verse 15 talks about the framework. Verse 31 talks about a curtain to separate a particular special place in the center that we've learned to call the Holy of Holies. And on it goes. Very different conversation. Do you see that? Okay. Now, your job was to read this. Did you do your job? Yeah, I thought maybe not. Okay. Your job now is to read it with some sense of what you're looking at. And what I want to do now is I want to walk through it. I want to pick out some things that as you read, I want you to pay special attention to. Fair enough? You've got a sense of the overview. The first part seems to be talking about interactions between people, interactions between people's animals and other things, and interactions between people and God. The second conversation, the one that comes after that interlude, is talking mostly about how people are to worship and the context, the place in which the worship is to take place. Okay, so let's go back now to chapter 21, and I want to begin to hit some highlight points. These are just bringing your attention to some things that you need to see. Take a look at verse 23 of chapter 21. I'm allowing you to go back and figure out the context later. I just want you to look at that verse. If further harm is done, however, you will award life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and stroke for stroke. Anybody want to count? Life, eye, tooth, hand, foot, burn, wound, and stroke. I count seven, not counting the word life that begins it all. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Jesus commented on this in the Sermon on the Mount. This was a big step forward. It was not only under Moses that the people of the world would have heard this. This was parallels were seen in other places, but it was a limiting of revenge. Somebody happens to stumble and kick you in the shins, you don't get to kill them. Maybe you get to kick them in the shins. That was an advancement of sorts, but Jesus took it further when he came. Okay? Take a look at chapter 22, verse 28. I want to read this in my translation, and I want to find out if your translation has any sense of an echo of this. Do not be slow about making offerings. That's the way mine starts. Does yours start that way? Chapter 22, verse 28. It's 29 in yours? Fine, make it 29. Do not be slow about making offerings. Does yours start that way?
Yes.
Okay. Now, here's how mine finishes. Do not be slow about making offerings from your abundance, from your surplus. Does yours have that?
No.
What does yours say?
Vats.
From your harvest or your vintage and your vintage.
And then it talks about firstborn. First fruits and firstborn are coming, but they haven't come yet in my translation. I'll tell you there's an echo in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians says you should give. Charity should be part of your character, part of your day-to-day living. But you should not give in such a way that it leaves you in want. You should give from your surplus. And in the days in which you're in want, someone else will give from their surplus. Your surplus fills their needs. Their surplus in the future will fill your needs. That's the balance that ought to happen. That's what 1 Corinthians says. Since I've said 1 Corinthians, it's probably 2 Corinthians. I didn't go look it up, but it's around chapter 8 in one of those. That's an echo of this little place, I think. And it's important. Now, what are the signs of those offerings that you're making? What are the offerings you make? You make offerings from the first fruits. Work with me here. What does first fruits mean?
First fruits.
I didn't grow up on a farm. My granddaddy had one, so I've seen farms. My understanding is the harvest doesn't all come in on one day. There's some crops that maybe it does. You harvest the whole thing on one day. But there's other crops that you start getting tomatoes, and the tomatoes just keep coming if things are going well. Doesn't happen much at our house, but maybe at your house it does. You get tomatoes today, you get tomatoes tomorrow, you get zucchini today, you get zucchini tomorrow. It just sort of keeps coming in. The gift is from the first. That implies a faith that more is coming because you're giving with an expectation that more will come behind. First fruits. But it also says firstborn. What does firstborn mean? The first calf from a cow. The first foal from a donkey. The first chick from a chicken, I guess. What else is firstborn? Your first child. Your first child, this section says. Have you scanned ahead a little bit? I know you haven't read this, most of you. Have you scanned ahead today? Okay. For the first 7 days, the firstborn will stay with its mother. On the eighth day, you will give it to me. That verse, in my translation, is verse 29, so it's probably verse 30 for you. You will give me the firstborn of your children. You will do the same with your flocks and herds. For the first 7 days, the firstborn will stay with its mother. On the eighth day, you will give it to me. What happened when Jesus was 8 days old? Took him to the temple. Why? Because of this law. He was the firstborn son. They took him to the temple. For what purpose? To give him to God. But what else happened? They redeemed him. And you have to go to other places to see the redemption. If you take a look at, we're still in Exodus. Hold your place because we're not leaving here. But go to chapter 34 and look at verse 20.
Samuel.
Yeah, I was sitting here thinking about Samuel. Verse 19 of Exodus 34. All that first issues from the womb belongs to me. Every male, every firstborn of flock or herd. But the firstborn donkey you will redeem with another animal from the flock. I think some translations say with a lamb. If you do not redeem it, you must break its neck. All of the firstborn of your sons you will redeem, and no one will appear before me empty-handed. There's a provision later that says what the offering is that is an offering of redemption. And I think it's a lamb or a bull or something like that. But it says if you're poor, it's two doves. What was the offering that Mary made for Jesus? Two doves, signaling that they were poor. The idea of redemption is coming real, real early in this. Take a look at chapter 21, verse 13. This is the section I told you that was about murder and accidental death. Anyone who causes violence, who by violence causes a death, must be put to death. If, however, he has not planned to do it, but it has come from God by his hand, he can take refuge in a place which I will appoint for you. Cities of refuge were built where people who accidentally caused a death could go and seek shelter from the revenge that otherwise might be coming. This was again a step forward in the way things worked in those days. Were you here for Hot Topics on Wednesday night? One of our guests was a Catholic priest, right? A couple of you were here. And the Catholic priest said the position of the Catholic Church is, did he say the death penalty is forbidden?
No.
Nope. Said the death penalty is allowed. But it's strongly, strongly, strongly discouraged. And he walked the line there. Why is it allowed? It's allowed here. But you got to make sure you distinguish between the guilty and the innocent. And he says, that's the rub. That's the rub. Chapter 22, verse 20 to 23. You will not molest or oppress aliens, for you yourselves were once aliens in Egypt. You will not ill-treat widows or orphans. If you ill-treat them in any way and they make any appeal to me for help, I will certainly hear their appeal. My anger will be roused. I will put you to the sword, and your own wives will be widows, and your own children will be orphans. Special protection for the poor. If you lend money to any of my people or to any of the poor among you, you will not play the usurer with him. You will not demand interest from him. If you take someone's cloak in pledge, you will return it to him at sunset. If it's all the covering he has, what else will he sleep in? If he appeals to me, I will listen. Protection written in for the weak in the society. Make sure you see that. And then finally in this part, I'd like you to take a look at the last little bit of chapter 23. God says, verse 20, look, I am sending an angel to precede you. I'm sending an angel to precede you. Precede you where? Into the promised land. To guard you as you go and to bring you to the place I have prepared. Revere him and obey what he says. Do not defy him, for my name is in him. My angel will precede you, verse 23 says, and lead you to the home of the, and he names the nations that are going to be driven out or exterminated. Verse 24, you will not bow down to their gods or worship them or observe their rites. You must throw down those idols, smash their cultic stones. You will worship the Lord your God, and I will bless you. And he gives the details of how the blessings will come. Critics of Christianity and critics of the Bible love to come into this part of Exodus to find things to throw in the face of those who believe. This is one of them. It sounds like genocide. And as the pastor said at 8 o'clock, let me apologize again. I'm giving you a little spoiler notice here. I don't understand this one. I have a way of rationalizing, but I don't pretend to understand it. Why was this needed? However, I do notice something very, very interesting. If you keep reading, you come down to verse 32. I think it's either 32 or 33. It's going to drive out all the people, give you the land. And one of the last two sentences, you will make no pact or treaty with them or with their gods. Do you find that? Verse 32, 33. You will make no pact or treaty with them or with their gods. They may not stay in your country or what? They might make you sin against me, for you would serve their gods, and that would be a snare for you. Okay? I think we got time to do this, and maybe we'll stop at that point. I want you to turn over to Joshua chapter 9. Joshua chapter 9. By the time you get to Joshua, the wandering in the wilderness is over. The people are beginning to enter the promised land. The things that God had promised are beginning to take place. The people of Jericho and Ai have been destroyed and moved out. Chapter 9, verse 1. What was the reaction of the people who hadn't yet been driven out? Verse 1 and 2 tells you the reaction of some of the people. Hearing these things, all the kings on this side of Jordan, that was the side toward the Mediterranean, in the highlands and in the lowlands, along the coast of the Great Sea toward the Lebanon, Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and it names them all, with one consent formed a fighting alliance against Joshua and Israel. They banded together to fight this threat. Verse 3, though, tells you one group took a different tack. These were the Gibeonites. When the inhabitants of Gibeon learned how Joshua had treated Jericho and Ai, for their part, they had recourse not to an alliance, but to a ruse. R-U-S-E. A ruse. That's not a word you hear very often. You hear the word rose, but you don't hear the word ruse. What's ruse? A sneaky trick. A sneaky trick. What's their sneaky trick? Well, you got the whole of a whole huge section here. Let me just tell you. What they did was they got some really, really, really old and moldy bread. They took clothes that had been worn for years and were rags, dressed themselves in it, came to the leaders of Israel and said to them, "We have come from a great, great distance. We've heard about what's happening. When we left home, our bread was warm. Look at it now. When we left home, our clothes were new. Look at them now. We've come from a great, great, great distance." What they'd come from was over the next hill. But they said they'd come from a great distance. "Make a treaty with us. Make a pact with us." Have you now put the two things together? What was the command back in Exodus? Don't make a treaty with them. What are they saying? Make a treaty with us. We're impressed. This is great. We live a long, long way away. Look at our bread. Look at our clothes. Make a treaty with us. And there's a powerful sentence that hides in the middle of this. Verse 14. The leaders of Israel sampled some of the food they offered. But what? They did not inquire of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them. He struck a treaty with them, guaranteeing their lives, and the leaders of the community ratified it by oath. And the things that happened after this were awful. I don't know how to rationalize this any other way but this. Here it is. If you have cancer and they go to operate, what do you hope? That they get it all. If they leave any behind, what happens? You are at risk of that little bit spreading. I don't know how to reconcile this, and I'm not suggesting that this accomplishes it. But what seems to be happening is the inhabitants were treated as a cancer, and the cancer had to be excised. You leave any of it behind, you don't get it all, and you got troubles. What happened? They didn't get it all. Guess what? They had trouble. Okay? The interlude is chapter 24, I think it is. We've read about the interlude. We will start next time on chapter 25 and look a little bit at the details there. Some of the details that are there. There are details you need to see. Here's what I want you to see, though. There's a big sort of overarching piece, and I want to make sure you see this as you go. They heard the voice of God. Their leaders saw what Moses has seen. And yet, within 40 days and 40 nights, it seems as if they had forgotten everything. And by the time you get to chapter 32, which I hope to get you get to chapter 32 before this week is over, what you find is there is a total collapse. And they are doing the number one thing God said not to do. They're setting up false gods to worship instead of God. And the leaders who saw God are doing it. And their reason is, we don't know where Moses is. We don't know if he's ever going to come back. We don't know where God is. Give us a God. And out came an idol. The horror of that. Here's Moses on the one hand getting the instructions. Here's how you're going to worship me. And here's the people for whom he's listening, abandoning the little bit that they know. And what they know is more than enough. What's the message? We do that too. Don't read this with a sense of arrogance. Oh, I wouldn't have done that if I'd been there. Read that with a sense of humility. This is what we do. So, we're stopping in the middle. We'll join back up on this next week. Thank you for being here. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, sometimes somebody prays for us. Let our eyes be opened, and we get a glimpse of the greater things. It's what you are and what you do. When we get those glimpses, and you give those glimpses to each of us, don't let us turn around and be blind about what we've seen. You've given us insights into who you are and how you function. You've given us a call to be your children. Help us not to miss that call. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.